The Northwestern United States is no stranger to rule breakers and iconoclasts and outright outlaws, and that's kind of what we have in mind for today. Lorraine, how have rule breakers kind of figured into the history of the Pacific Northwest and its identity?
Certainly, rule breakers were the founders of Seattle. They were the first settlers of Seattle. You don't settle Puget Sound without leaving behind a comfortable, convenient home, which you reject in order to choose something very new. Coming to the West to grow up with the country, coming to the West to brutally suppress Native people, coming to the West to make patents, to make a living, to make a killing, all of this is part of rule breaking as innovation. All innovators must break rules. They have to break the paradigm, or they would just keep doing business as usual. So we see Jeff Bezos, we see Bill Gates, we see Jim Ellis, we see Paul Allen, we see Jeff Brotman, we see Alice Lord, we see Susan Stern. We see a long series of rule breakers who changed the paradigm. That's what innovation is.
Well, it ain't always pretty and it ain't always clean, but rule breaking is such a crucial part of our story here in the Pacific Northwest. That is what we're talking about today here on Sound Effect. Here with me is Lorraine McConaghy, who's a public historian at the Museum of History and Industry in Seattle. And she's going to be back a little bit later on in the show to tell us about a really fascinating case study in rule breakers of the Northwest. Lorraine, come back in a couple minutes, okay?
You betcha.
All right. We'll see you in a little bit. We'll be breaking plenty of rules later on in the hour, but first, let's get caught up on what happened this week with a panel of pretty smart, interesting people coming up right here on Sound Effect. Well, we got Seahawks, we got Bertha, we got state budget, we got a little bit of everything. The news is sort of coming on pretty hard and heavy here in the first, I would call this the first real news week of the new year anyway. And here to help us break it down, we have three guests. Noah Haglund covers government at the Herald of Everett. Sarah Studeville is a co-founder and creative director of Seattle Globalist. And Tanya Mosley is an independent journalist here in Seattle. Hi, everybody. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So we're going to talk a little bit about what each of you considers the top story of the week. Then we're going to get into our nominees for overreported and underreported story of the week as well. And for our top story, we have some consensus once again that the top story is an international story. So let's go to our globalist for starters. What's your nominee for top story of the week, Sarah Studeville?
I think it'd be hard to make an argument for anything other than Charlie Hebdo again this week as the top story internationally, the top story here in the U.S. as well. It's kind of the story on everybody's lips and what everyone's talking about.
And how has this story morphed from what you can see this week from last week?
I think this week you start to see people talking about kind of the significance of this beyond the shock and grief and kind of just initial outpourings of sympathy. A lot of discussions about how immigrant communities are and aren't assimilated into communities in the United States and in Europe. And then, of course, a lot of discussion about what does it mean to be tolerant? What are definitions of free speech? How is that different from culture to culture?
That question about how we assimilate immigrants, and even immigrants who aren't really immigrants, who are the children and grandchildren of immigrants, came up in a really interesting piece that you did about a local person. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this was actually another one of our reporters at the Seattle Globalist, but we covered the French community's response here in Seattle. I think one of the kind of surprising things for me this week was learning how big a French community
there's
we actually
French
have in
community.
Seattle. There's a French community here. There's actually a couple of little Parises and a more significant community than I knew about. And so we kind of went out and sought a reaction from them. A lot of what you would expect, just trying to get in contact with people back home, kind of looking for company among fellow French people here in Seattle. But one of the more interesting responses we got was from a kind of high-profile baker here in Seattle. She, Nora Belade, she runs Inez Patisserie on Capitol Hill. And she is, her family is of Algerian and Lebanese background. And she talked a lot about just how a lot of those communities in France just don't feel like France is their country.
So this week, we're really starting to see some of the complexity underneath the surface of this really dastardly deed. I mean, it's revealed a lot of the social complexity underneath. Does that ring true for you, Tanya Mosley?
Absolutely. I agree with Sarah on so many points. I think that for me personally, as we enter the second week in coverage and just thoughts and analysis about it, I really start to look at our country and how immigrants are able to, we use the term assimilate, but that is really what this country is based on. And many countries really push for those immigrants to assimilate as they come in. And some of the challenges and the issues with that, because ultimately, we say you need to keep your culture, you need to keep who you are and stay who you are, but at the same time, there's this idea of assimilation. And what does assimilation actually mean in keeping with who you are and what you bring to the table?
So, Noah Hagelin, do you buy the Charlie Hebdo as top story second week running?
I can agree with that. I think it's, you know, there's been a lot of understandable anger and people are struggling to express that and not play into that us against them sort of mentality, which is, you know, if you think about it, the front lines of this conflict, whatever it is, run through, you know, they run through Nigeria, they run through Pakistan, where minority populations, minority religious groups are being subjected to this violence. So, you know, it's one of those things where we have to step back and think of the global ramifications of this problem and not just maybe the tunnel vision we get from the snippets we see on news outlets.
So we have been talking about it a lot. Too much, Sarah Studeville? Is this really an overreported story?
You know, that's a great question. That it was my nomination for top story and overreported story. And I think what I meant by saying that it was overreported is as we moved into week two, this is where the story does get gray. And I've covered the war on terror and terrorism for 8 years now in a number of countries around the world. And it's one of those issues, like so many, that can be both black and white. You know, we know that what happened in France 2 weeks ago was a horrible, disgusting act. And it is also so gray and so complex. And we really can't talk about the war on terror or terrorism in any other way. So when I said overreported, I think I was really ready for the conversation to get into the gray. And some of that kind of black and white mentality still felt overreported to me. And then, of course, you know, you have to mention that same week, a huge Boko Haram attack in Nigeria gets almost no international news coverage. Far bigger attack, far more people killed. So I think that also kind of came into play when I was thinking Hebdo is becoming overreported this week.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. We are talking about our over and underreported stories of the week. Tanya Mosley, what's your nominee for overreported story?
We have Seahawks fever right now. And I have Seahawks fever right now, even though I'm not a huge football fan. I'm a fair weather fan. But I think in that story, I am so tired of hearing about Marshawn Lynch not talking to the media.
Yes.
I don't even see why this is a story beyond the fact that it is the NFL basically has these rules that say you have to talk to the media. But this over-analysis of who he is, why he might be doing it, I actually heard that maybe he suffers from anxiety. And I heard a whole story on the radio about what anxiety looks like. And this is all just based on this idea, based on how he acts, whether or not this is indeed true. And we have no fact to take that through to that idea.
So we put him on the couch a little bit here. We're trying to psychoanalyze the guy.
Yeah, we're psychoanalyzing him. And I happen to love him, and I happen to be okay with the fact that he's not talking to us.
So Marshawn Lynch's reticence with the media, an overreported story. Noah Hagelin, what's your nominee for overreported story this time around?
I'm a little bit sick. In this, we could have said this a year ago or maybe even 2 years ago, but I'm a little bit sick of seeing pot leaves everywhere and stories about, you know, labs where they're testing, you know, the potency of different strains and grow operations. And to a certain extent, I know we're all curious about this new landscape. It's something new, but, you know, enough is enough. You know, people are really curious about these topics. There are no shortage of trade magazines and, you know, websites that specialize in nothing but, you know, you know, all cannabis right. All the time. So, you know, I think that the mainstream media is devoting so much attention to it at times just feels, you know, a bit misguided.
Well, legal pot, overreported story of the week from Noah Hagelin. Noah, do you have a nominee for underreported story of the week?
I said the state legislature, largely because there's so few people reporting on such major issues. We have, to a large extent, the whole tax structure of the state under discussion. We have funding of education, you know, environmental policies, you know, very, very important issues at play. And, My colleague in Olympia, Jerry Kornfield, told me that at least full-time, there are only about a half dozen, you know, full-time reporters
wow.
covering Olympia. Maybe a little bit more than that, but not too many. And, you know, at the same time, what's always bothered me a little bit is, and I know there are practical reasons for this, but the state lawmakers aren't subject to the same public information requirements that other public officials in the state are. So you can't just send in a public records request and get a bunch of emails for your state senator or your state representative. They're specifically exempted.
So underreported. All right. Noah Hagelin's underreported story of the week. Sarah Studeville, what's your nominee for underreported?
You know, I think a really interesting underreported story for this week and really this month is the closing of the single only bilingual courtroom in Washington State. And I reported on this for my column on the Seattle Globalist and in the Seattle Times last week. There's this amazing judge. Judge Galvan is and has been presiding over the municipal court in Des Moines, I think for the past 7 years. And I went and talked to her last week, and she said about 6 weeks or I think a month or so into doing that, she just realized that there was a need for being able to conduct the courtroom in Spanish as well as English. We have a state mandate that means that anyone who asks for an interpreter will get one if they go to court, but that usually happens over the telephone, kind of over speakerphone. It can be unreliable. Sometimes the translators don't show up. But also, Justice Galvan says there's something really specific about the entire courtroom being conducted in a language that the people before her totally understand. So she offered, I think, 2 different sessions a month where it was all court was conducted in Spanish. It became incredibly popular. And she says really helped her kind of connect to the Spanish-speaking population that she was serving, and also just the international community in general. She is moving on. She's been appointed to the King County Superior Court, I believe. And so she'll be moving on, and the bilingual court will be closing unless whoever replaces her can pick that up.
Happens to
be a fluent Spanish speaker.
Oh, that's a great underreported story. Yeah. We wouldn't have known about it otherwise. So, Tanya Mosley, what is your nominee for underreported story of the week?
We read a few months ago that Seattle is becoming the fastest growing major city in the country. And along with that, there were these numbers, statistics. And we also heard that Seattle is becoming whiter. And I thought that was really interesting because overall, in some of the outlining areas, and Sarah spoke to this, Tukwila, Des Moines, we are seeing that they are becoming more diverse. But there is this story that we focus so much on Seattle. We're very Seattle-centric. I hear people who live in other parts of the county and parts of the Pacific Northwest who say, I can't even turn on the local news or read the newspaper without hearing about Seattle. With that, I'd love to know how some of those outlining areas are changing in meaningful ways as far as the composition of people, the racial makeup, and also just the dynamic of the neighborhoods, housing, jobs. And I think that I would love to hear more about how those other areas are changing as Seattle grows.
So there's a really underreported aspect of a pretty familiar story. Well, joining us this week, we had Noah Hagelin, who is the government reporter at the Everett Herald, Sarah Studeville, who's co-founder and creative director at Seattle Globalist. Tanya Mosley is an independent journalist in Seattle. Thank you all so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, it was great.
Thank you so much.
Just ahead on Sound Effect, we are going to meet a few of our region's rule breakers. That's right here on KPLU. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We are talking this week about rule breakers. And KPLU's Ed Ronco joins us now. He's in the studio to talk about a rule breaker that he met. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Gabriel. Okay, so we're going to hear from a Seattle drag queen whose name in and of itself might break a rule, at least maybe the rules of polite society. We should tell you, in this segment, we're going to address some adult topics, beginning with her name. Now, this drag queen is the creation of a guy named Brian Peters. She performs each Sunday on Capitol Hill, and her name is Mama Tits.
So for those of you who've never been out here before, we are a crazy, wild, irreverent show, if you haven't figured out. I am goodness and light. I am nothing but sweet purity up here. And I will take you on this journey. It's everybody else you got to watch out for. They're trash. They're all just...
Could you describe yourself physically for people who can't see you?
Well, I'm 6 foot six. I weigh more than 250 pounds, but I actually wear my weight pretty evenly, thank God. So I'm big, stocky. I look like a linebacker, and my boobs are 44 triple D.
Oh, I forgot to tell you, I'm a dude. So if that changes things.
Do you consider yourself a rule breaker?
Completely. I'm one of those people that just because you tell me that that's the way things should be doesn't mean that I believe it. You know, I grew up in San Jose, Cupertino, San Rafael, and then we moved out later into Stockton, California. And, you know, I was one of four white kids. So it's like I've been on that end of it. I've been the first out gay male in my high school's history in Nampa, Idaho, when we left California and went to Idaho. Whoa. And I don't follow what I guess societal norm is. I just kind of follow the tune of my own drummer. And sometimes it gets me in trouble. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, it's not what you say, it's how you say it.
Is performing in drag part of how you say it?
Oh, my goodness. The way that drag is that I can then take myself, and aside from just wearing fabulous clothes and wigs and whatnot, I've completely covered who I am. And I wear this mask, and this mask of this character gives me this power of anonymity. And it's something I learned from being a Sister of Perpetual Indulgence, which is an organization based on rule breaking.
And the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, this is, just to clarify, a group that was founded in San Francisco. They dress up in drag as nuns and then go out into the streets and do good works.
They were the first ones to do the first candlelight vigil for AIDS victims. They were the first ones to organize pretty much everything that has happened in HIV/AIDS awareness and activism since it began in 1979. That was my what I consider boot camp. It was my going to university. Because you can be angry about something and you can have something really upset you and you can want to make a change. But if you go about it the wrong way, you're going to do nothing but hinder your cause. If you do it the right way, you will further it.
So I want to ask you about the Pride Parade, the most recent Pride Parade. You confronted some protesters that came down the street before the parade started. Describe what happened from your point of view.
This is the fifth year that I've hosted the Seattle Pride Parade. It's been a huge honor. They asked me as a sister 5 years ago. Sylvia Ostafermore actually asked me to join her. This year, we were invited to do Westlake Center, which was the pinnacle of the parade. And it's a huge honor. And we're in the pause between the pre-show and the actual parade. And I look down and I see these signs come around the corner. And I say to myself, I'm like, oh, hell no, because I can read these yellow signs that say, repent for your sins. And it was just all these little Bible-esque quotes of just damnation.
You thought that they had just kind of entered the parade route?
I thought they had just crashed the parade. I didn't find out that they had had a permit until weeks later. So I see them come around the corner, and I was livid. Mind you, I was in blue hair, aqua blue sequin dress, and a glitter rainbow on my boobs. And the next thing I know, they're in front of me. So I literally just throw my arms out as if I'm being nailed to a cross so that I'm a wall, a human wall.
Well, you had this confrontation.
So he comes up and I get out, my arms are outstretched and I'm like, no, you're not passing me. And I keep jumping in front of him every time he tries to dodge me. And I was doing it to antagonize him. So Seattle police would remove him. He got so frustrated with me, he ended up pushing on me. There was that moment where the photo captures me stepping to him. And then there's another photo of him just pressing on me. And right after that photo was snapped, he whacks me in the head with his sign. So I toss his sign out of his face and I let him go. And he walked up to the end and he ran into the Dykes on Bikes, which are the head of the Seattle Pride Parade. And they wouldn't let him pass. So he turned around and then is when the video starts picking up.
Why don't you read your own book and actually follow the teachings to the letter of God and learn to support and love? You need to drop the hate. You are a sad, sad excuse for a human being. Once you learn to drop the hate, you too can find happiness, because we will welcome you in
What are you thinking as this is happening?
Be completely accountable for everything that you say.
Explain that.
The reason why I was mad at this man was he was not being accountable for the words that were coming out of his mouth. He was spewing vitriol and hate. And what I imagine in my head is the one person in the crowd behind the crowd. This is the last thing they needed to hear. And they were trying to come out to a parade to be okay with themselves. Then they hear this and they go commit suicide. Or what about that person who hears it and they're like, that's all I needed, and they go do a gay bashing? Or what about the parent who is there trying to support their kid, but they hear this and then they're like, you know what, I can't do this. You're going to go to hell. And then now this kid doesn't have any family that loves and supports them. That's why I was angry, because I was like, you have commandeered our parade. We don't go to your revival and come in and start spewing how evil and nasty you are. We leave you alone. But you decide to come to our event that we have paid the city for, that we have permitted legally, that we have every right to do. And if you want your own, go ahead, do your own. Obviously, he could. But he couldn't get an audience. So he wanted to steal our audience. And that's what angered me, is I was like, why would you do that?
The YouTube clip, as of December, has like 1.8 million hits, give or take. Has it changed things for Mama or for Brian?
Wow. I woke up Monday morning and everybody knew who I was. It went global. I was just thinking about the fact that this man had upset me and he was not being accountable for his words, and I wanted him to be accountable, and I didn't want everybody to hear his hate. I was like, this is not what this is about. And then to wake up in the morning and have it hit so many people, it's truly humbling. It's like, holy God.
It affected you too.
Yeah. It was an extremely emotional day. Because I think of all of the people that have had to deal with this hate and didn't feel supported. All of the people that feel worthless. All the people that feel like something's wrong with them because they're not the way that somebody else told them that they should be. And it hurts me, because I am proud to be a freak. I am proud to be a faggot. I am proud to be a queen. And through that, I am proud to be a survivor of abuse and HIV. I am proud of all of these things. I am not ashamed. And I don't want anybody else to be.
Brian Peters, also known as the drag queen Mama Tits, talking with KPLU's Ed Ronco. He performs each Sunday afternoon at Mimosas with Mama inside the Unicorn Narwhal on Seattle's Capitol Hill. We have pictures and a much longer conversation with Brian Peters on our website, kplu.org. Okay, so there you have what I think for most of us is kind of a feel-good story about breaking the rules, but now on to some rule breakers where it's a lot less clear how you're supposed to feel about them. These are the people who have very little regard for rules like no peeing in the alley, no passing out on the sidewalk, no selling drugs in the park. And the question is, what happens when that kind of rule breaking goes unpunished? And now there's been a lot of hand-wringing in Seattle about this lately, and a lot of it is centered around certain downtown spaces, and especially Westlake Park. So I headed down there to meet with a senior guy from the Seattle Police Department because I wanted to know how you go about enforcing the rules in a place like this. But before we meet him, we are going to meet somebody else. Now, this is one of the guys you've seen probably lounging around there, not doing a whole heck of a lot except smoking and maybe glowering. But as you're about to hear, he's also something of a sociologist. And a heads up, there are a handful of beeped words coming up. He would give his name only as Shake.
Like Shake, Rattle, and Roll.
What kind of folks come down here? How would you describe it to people who had never been here before?
Scumbags, juggalos, and raver kids.
What's the scene like?
I don't know the scene. I'm not part of the scene anymore. I'm too old. Those kids over there, they're part of the scene.
Yeah, you feel like you're in a different generation from that crew on the camp?
I'm a generation removed. All those kids, I grew up watching these kids. They learned everything from me.
How much older do you think that you are from them then?
I don't know. three or four years, which is like 20 years in gutter punk time. So they're doing the same old shit, but worse.
Like what?
They're just worse, man. Like all these kids, they grew up out here like dropping a E-bomb and having fun and being all happy. And they made fun of all the strung out, burnout. Like, you know, we were like too late for the whole grunge, like nihilist generation, but we still like carried over some of that pessimism. All these kids were all like happy and like, you know, jumping around wearing candy bracelets, but now they're all part of the same scene, man. They're sitting there with like their mouths hanging open and flies like, you know, flying in and out of their mouths and same old thing.
Are you pals with those guys or not necessarily?
No, yeah, I'm pals with them. Yeah, they're all right. I wouldn't call them like friends. Yeah. You know, like, you know, I'm tentative with all those kids.
So Westlake Park in general, like, would you say, like, how safe or unsafe would you say this place is?
Oh, it's safe. You know, as long as you're like, don't get involved with it, you're all right. If you don't know these people, you should probably stay away from them. I don't know, this place isn't dangerous. Nobody's gonna like attack you randomly. Like the people that get attacked and beat up around here, it's because they were like, you know, in the shit in the first place. They were involved in it.
Would you say you see more cops now than before or any different?
Hell yeah, way more cops, way more police now.
What do you think the cops that are here should be doing?
I don't know, pretty much what they're doing. They're good. They're good. Actually, the cops ain't bad. See, the cops back in the day, there was only a few of them, but they just beat you up and, like, take your Like, the cops nowadays, they actually kind of try to help. They're not bad. There's just a lot of them.
So I met up with one of those officers. Captain Chris Fowler is in charge of SPD's West Precinct, which covers downtown, including Westlake Park, and we took a walk. Give me a sense of kind of how you see a space like this. Like, let us look through your eyes a little bit. What are you looking for and what are you paying attention to?
So we're really committed to making sure the park is available for everybody that wants to use it. I think we find out over many years in policing that we always can't arrest our way out of a situation. Clearly, if there's violence, clearly if there's domestic violence, clearly if there's such a behavioral crisis that that person needs help, we're always there available to either make an arrest if necessary or to detain the individuals and get them into the services that they're needed. But what we see on a daily basis are really just people who live here, and it was never intended for that purpose, so we have to figure out a different way.
Yeah, because it's hard to do that without breaking some laws, right? I mean, where do you go to the bathroom? Where do you smoke your pot? Where do you go when you're drunk?
Yeah, absolutely. And it isn't just a matter of law enforcement. I mean, the laws are designed so that if somebody does something that's against the law or a violation and you write them a ticket, then they feel compelled to not do it again, to pay their ticket. But you're talking about people that are in economic crisis, that have serious mental health issues, and that type of enforcement does not always work. When I got to the West Precinct, we put together a bit of a continuum of response. So on one end of the continuum, it's pure outreach to those individuals that truly want a place to live, they want services. And on the other end, it's an arrest to push through the criminal justice system.
Those have got to be hard calls to make on the spot, I imagine. So what's an officer have to evaluate? When you come up to somebody, how do I know?
Well, a lot of times the officers will get to know these people. You work down here every day and you say the same people over and over, you begin to know. I warned him 3 days ago, 2 days ago, this individual's really in crisis.
So when you're dealing with a range of responses, how do you take care that you're not enforcing the law selectively based on, say, unconscious biases?
Well, it comes down to the objective fact. Did the individual break a specific violation or a law? And if they did, what have we done to address that? So it's all about the individual's actions, not necessarily the demographic or the group that they hang out in. It gets a little muddy when you've got different groups that are out here doing different levels of crime. And although we're in Westlake Park and this is much more of a social service outreach park violation kind of issue, we can walk up a block to 3 and Pine and see where more criminal activity comes into play.
Well, shall we do that?
Sure.
All right. We headed down Pine and hung a left on 3rd Avenue, and within a minute, we came upon police activity.
Yeah, so we're in a bus stop that's mid-block between Pike and Pine. One of our law enforcement partners is the Metro Transit Security. They're making an arrest.
What's going on?
He's smoking in a posted no-smoking area all along the wall here, with the owners here wanting to clean up this area a little bit, so we're helping him out doing that. He's got a warrant, so he's going to jail for the warrant.
He's not going to jail for smoking.
No, definitely not. It's a citation. They'll more than likely be out tomorrow.
There was a report that was presented last year to the Community Police Commission that showed apparently that enforcement of these kind of low-level crimes that we're talking about was down substantially, something like 50% between 2005 and 2013. How do you read a stat like that?
Clearly, the enforcement is down because we're looking at other options in dealing with the same problem.
So you see that as a basically good news, that there's a wider range of options available to you to help people and address the issues than just arrests.
Yes, because at the end of the day, the officer's job is to either assist the individuals or enforce the laws. I mean, we're an enforcement agency. But we certainly want to help people that need that help. And we need other social services, other city agencies to help us do that. But at the end of the day, if the hospitals don't have the capacity to deal with the behavioral health issues, if there's not enough beds, then they're right back out on the street again. And at some point, they end up getting into the enforcement side of it.
Another question that that report begged is whether or not officers are, you know, the term that gets used is de-policing, whether they are reluctant to assert their authority in different cases for a variety of reasons, but a big one would be this consent decree we have with the Justice Department addressing use of force and biased policing. Is that making officers too skittish?
I don't think skittish is the right word, and certainly there may have been a little speed bump early on in the whole settlement agreement process. I think at this point, though, as we figured out the new policies and the new procedures, officers now have a clearer idea of what their expectations are, although we still have work in that area. But whenever you change a lot of procedures, it takes a period of time to work through those.
A lot of the conversation about, you know, what's the right level of enforcement for low-level crime comes back to the broken windows theory, the idea that disorder, low-level offenses, visible quality of life crimes can lead to a sense that there is not social controls in an area and that then people can, you know, be free to do more serious crime. I don't know, where are you with that philosophy? You must have thought about it. Is there a connection? What is the connection between these quality of life crimes and more major crime?
Well, I think that's an oversimplification, that if you allow quality of life issues to exacerbate, then the whole area falls apart. I don't believe that's the case. We saw over the last couple of years where, in fact, those very quality of life issues have gotten worse downtown. But really what's happened is the community stepped up, reestablished their expectations. We sort of re-energized our efforts along with many other agencies within the city. So I think instead of seeing an enhance and decay, what you see is a community stepping up to address some of these issues across a broad spectrum. And so before seeing that, I might have said, yeah, if you let people sleep on the sidewalks, if you let them drink, if you let them smoke, then the whole place goes downhill. But in fact, I think everybody begins to step up to address some of these issues. And they're long-term and they're complicated.
So you think your personal view on that has evolved a little bit?
It really has, yeah. I think it's forced everybody to take action versus just sit back and point the finger at each other. And that includes the police department.
Captain Chris Fowler is in charge of SPD's West Precinct, which includes Westlake Park and most of downtown. Stick around, we are about to meet a young woman who had to put her inner rule breaker in check. That's ahead on Sound Effect on KPLU. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we are meeting a whole bunch of rule breakers and trying to understand maybe just a little bit about why they break the rules. So the place so many of us learn how to be good little followers of rules is often in school. And Kyle Stokes, our education reporter, is with me now to talk a little bit about this and how big of a deal it is in Washington. Kyle, what's the scope of the problem? Give me some numbers.
It's a pretty big deal, Gabe. Washington schools handed down 67,000 suspensions last school year. Because of those suspensions, Washington students missed a grand total of 288,000 days of class. And so kind of makes you wonder what these kids need, you know, these kids who are breaking the rules, how do you make sure they don't break them? That's what got me sort of launched into this.
And what are they getting in trouble for? I mean, are we talking about getting in fights or setting fire to the school or what?
But setting fire to the school, yeah. Battle axes and, you know, bringing nunchucks to school, that kind of thing. But if you add up, actually, all of those kind of predictable offenses, things like bullying, violence, drugs, weapons, predictable in that you think, well, of course, these kids need to get suspended for that kind of thing. Those only account for about half of the suspensions or expulsions in Washington State. What's actually more common and what likely makes up a lot of that other half are suspensions for stuff like this.
Yeah, I kind of have an attitude. When you like say something to me, it kind of gets me heated. And so when I get heated, then that's when I get an attitude back.
Who is that?
Let's call this rule breaker Jennifer. That's a fake name, but she's a high school freshman now. But ask Jennifer how many times she got suspended in middle school, and she can't tell you. She's lost count.
If I asked your teachers at that time, what would they tell me about seventh grade Jennifer?
Problematic attitude, talking back.
She wouldn't just get into arguments with other kids in class. She'd get into arguments with her teachers. There's one fight that would play out. A teacher calls her out for talking in class. Jennifer would say, "I wasn't talking."
And that's when the whole conflict would start up because I would talk back to the teacher and they're like, "Don't talk back to me." And then I'd be like, "Well, I'm just being honest." And then they would get mad and they'd be like, "Please step out of my class." So I would walk out and then they'd come and talk to me. And then by that time, I probably had like a bigger attitude than I had when I was inside the classroom.
So I have little kids, like a preschooler, and this sounds very familiar. This is the classic power stroke.
I mean, and this would happen with Jennifer over and over again with her teachers.
They'd end up giving up and be like, "Just go to the office." And then, or I would just walk out of class and be like, "You know, I'm not going to be here no more. It's whatever."
Sometimes Jennifer would walk out and go straight to the office on her own. Sometimes she'd just tootle around the school, trying not to get caught. She didn't want to get in any more trouble.
How many days of the week would you say, in like the average week, how many times would you walk out of a class? How many classes would you walk out of?
At least 3 times a week.
So did you get a sense of like what was going on? Why was she doing it?
Yeah, a couple things. I mean, partially, that's just her personality. I mean, Jennifer's going to tell it like it is. She's frank to the point of defiance. And that defiance is what attracted the group of friends that she hung out with. But there are other factors, too. There were factors that she didn't really want to talk about in detail. But suffice it to say, Jennifer was fighting a lot with her mom. Her mom didn't like her boyfriend at the time. She actually ended up running away from home 3 times in 2013. The police got involved all 3 times.
Okay, so there's some serious home stuff that's kind of bleeding into the school mm-hmm. situation too, huh?
Exactly.
Okay, so what happened next?
Well, after she ran away for the 3rd time, so this was October 2013, the school put her in touch with Stephanie Edler. She's a counselor for this nonprofit called Sound Mental Health, but she worked in Jennifer's middle school, and Jennifer really credits Stephanie with getting her back on the right track.
So what got through to her?
Yeah, good question. There was this one piece of advice that Stephanie gave Jennifer, and I have to say it really stuck. Here's Stephanie.
Your friends love to watch a show, so her getting into it with a teacher in front of the classroom is entertaining. Unfortunately, you know, they have to find out the hard way who their true friends are. You know, once the show stops and she's doing better, now she's not, it's not as entertaining for them, you know? So, and I think that was a hard thing she eventually had to face because she's a very loyal friend. To see some of her friends drop off because she's no longer that Jennifer that blows up at teachers and walks out of the classroom, puts this huge show on for everyone's entertainment, not to mention stalls learning.
Let's just think about that for a second. I mean, this is a middle schooler we're talking about. This is telling a middle schooler, a very loyal friend, you have to figure out who your true friends are. Kind of baked into that, Gabe, is you got to get a whole new group of friends.
That can't be easy to hear. No. So did she do it?
Yeah, actually, she did. Moving up to high school, it's been a total fresh start for Jennifer. She's found new friends. She feels like classes are going better. Things are going better with her mom, even. And this year so far, no suspensions. For the most part, rule breaking's lost its appeal for Jennifer.
It just wasn't helping me at all for my life or for my future plans that I have for myself, you know? It's like, I want to go to college. I want to go to the university. I want to get a good job, you know? And I wanted to graduate with high school with good grades and stuff. And I realized that by getting in trouble and having an attitude with teachers and people around me, it's not going to help me. It's just going to bring me down more.
But the change isn't just about getting new friends. It was about facing her problems outside of school, too. And she says she could do that because Stephanie earned her trust.
She tries to understand the students as well as understand the teachers. I don't know how you do that, Miss Stephanie. You kind of divide yourself in half.
She divides herself in half. She listens. She makes it her job to listen, Gabe. And I think for the first time at school anyway, Jennifer felt like she was being heard.
Kyle Stokes covers education at KPLU, and he brought us this story of a rule breaker who learned to stop breaking the rules. Up next, we're going to meet a rule breaker who never stopped breaking the rules up to the bitter end. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we're talking about rule breakers today. And we're going to hear about a very interesting rule breaker from the past next. Her name is Susan Stern. She was one of the founding members of the Seattle Liberation Front back in the early 1970s. She was a member of the Weathermen and a very distinct case study in rule breaking. And so here to tell us a little bit more about her is Lorraine McGonaghy. She is public historian at MOHAI, the Museum of History and Industry here in Seattle. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi, Gabe.
So maybe you could start by explaining a little bit about what Seattle was like in that time period. They walk into a still kind of a backwater city in some respects with this more idealistic and ideological movement starting to take shape.
It's beginning to, but when they arrive, it's very much a counterculture. It's not deeply politicized, the left. So they arrive and participate fully in the sort of summer of love experience. And Susan writes about, you know, getting a long hippie skirt and bangles for her ears and traipsing up and down the Ave, smoking pot, and really just grooving to the music and the vibe. It's in 1967 that Susan and Robbie Stern join Students for Democratic Society, SDS. But SDS is undergoing its own tensions as we see the war on poverty eclipsed by the war in Vietnam, as we see the Voting Rights Act erased and eclipsed by violence in the South, and then Martin Luther King's assassination. The nonviolence of civil rights began to seem ridiculous.
As that split was kind of taking shape and the Weathermen were forming as their own coherent body, where did she find herself in that, and what was life like for her at that period?
She became part of the Weathermen Collective here in Seattle. And this was a very tight group, a very off-putting group. It was a Maoist political formation. The unwillingness of Weathermen to open their arms and welcome a spectrum of anti-war people is really characteristic, I think, of the radical nature of this rule-breaking, if you will. They isolated themselves. They militarized themselves. They armed themselves. They were ready to engage in violent revolution in Seattle.
So the Weathermen would later become more widely known and pretty infamous in the United States as a fairly violent outfit. How much of that did Susan Stern buy into? Was she a violent person?
Yes, I think she was. I think violence was a catharsis and an epiphany for her. She had a .22 revolver and she knew how to use it. She received a concussion and she gave blows in return. The violence of Susan Stern is a very real part of her evolution as a revolutionary woman.
So how did she find her way out of the Weathermen, and what did she do next?
Well, she was pushed out of Weathermen because of her intransigence, her stubbornness as a feminist. She rejected the SDS and Weathermen notion that men dominating the movement had the right to pick and choose women with whom they had sex. She resented and resisted the wargasm, the sense that monogamous relationships, that needed to be smashed in order to destroy the bourgeois inheritance of being a well-educated, well-off Jewish girl whose parents had divorced in an acrimonious custody. But she was just so stubborn about that. She was in love with a man. She was not in love with all revolutionary men. Also, she made her living through her sexuality. She did pornographic movies. She danced topless in Ballard at a bar. She talks in her autobiography about prancing around the collective in a G-string. I mean, she pushed back against the rules of the rule breakers as well as the rules of the rule makers. She was expelled from Weathermen and then joined Seattle Liberation Front in January of 1970. And it was much less political and restrictive than Weatherman had been.
Wow. And so that kind of, I mean, some of the restlessness of Susan Stern and of the movement at the time came to a head in 1970 in downtown Seattle. Set that up for us. What happened?
We have the accelerating war in Vietnam and Cambodia, the sense that the United States was involved in the repression of revolutionary movements all over the world and in the United States. You have the death of Fred Hampton. You have the suppression of Weatherman. I think there was a sense of really a precipitate edge, and that the precipitate edge had been met in 1970. SLF was only 1 month old when the action was called at the federal courthouse in downtown Seattle. And it was called as part of the day after, TDA, the day after the rulings were to be handed down against the Chicago Seven, who had been arrested during the Days of Rage. And the attack on the courthouse really began as a group of 2,000 of us standing there, not really sure what to do with all the anger. And that action at the courthouse, which involved people in their 60s, people who were people of faith, and some very radical young people, ended up taking downtown, if you will, breaking windows, throwing paint. No more business as usual. Bring the war home.
So it came home in that what was termed a riot in downtown Seattle, giving rise, as you said, to the Seattle 7 conspiracy trial. And she did do some jail time, right?
She did. They were charged with conspiracy to incite a riot. If you read the newspaper stories of the time, it is again and again, Susan Stern shouted obscenities at the judge. And they all just raised hell in that courtroom. And so there was a mistrial declared. And all of them were declared in contempt of court. She went to Purdy.
So she did some time there. And I guess the main charges were later dropped, right?
Yes.
You know, Susan Stern died in 1976 of a drug overdose, and she was only, like 33 years old?
Exactly.
So it seems strange to talk about her in her later years, but, you know, toward the end of her life, did she think any differently about those years than she did at the time?
In her last interview, she said that she was past all of that. And it seemed to mean past all of the drugs, all of the almost self-destructive behavior of destroying that upper middle class Jewish girl with white skin privilege and substituting a liberated revolutionary woman. No one knows, or at least I don't know, why then she was in a friend's house taking lots of alcohol and downers, and then in a sauna, and then found, and then to university hospital, onto life support. And the family against which she had pressed for so long made the decision to withdraw life support. You know, that is a full story and a short story. It's a story of a woman who broke all the rules, who broke many laws and most of the commandments, and in the end broke the rules of the rule breakers themselves to make herself a whole person.
Susan Stern, who died in 1976, one of the founders of the Seattle Liberation Front, a member of Weatherman and a number of other rule-breaking outfits. Lorraine McGonaghy is a historian at MOHAI. Thanks so much, Lorraine. This was really cool.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Sound Effect is produced by Arwin Nix with Kevin Kniestad. Contributions this week from Ed Ronco and Kyle Stokes. Special thanks to online managing editor Martha Kang and our executive producer, Aaron Hennessy. And a special thanks to Lorraine McConaughey and the Museum of History and Industry. You're going to be hearing a lot from them on this show. And if you haven't had a chance to check out their new location at South Lake Union, I do highly recommend it. Next week on Sound Effect, we are talking about rain.
It's like I'm jealous of the rain because the rain gets to see him all the time. You know, gets to be near him, gets to touch him, gets to see him, spend time with him in a sense.
Tune in and check us out online at kplusoundeffect.org. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.